Well, this morning we come to the second in what's a three-part mini-series looking at the call of a Premier League Bible character, Abraham. And so without any further introduction, I wonder whether you turn straight back to Genesis chapter 12, please. It's on page 9 of the Bibles that are on the seats with you. Genesis chapter 12 on page 9. Well, last week, if you were here last week, you'll remember that we studied just the first six words of Genesis chapter 12. Now, the Lord said to Abraham. And we noticed that it was God's initiative to call Abraham, that Abraham wasn't looking for God, that he didn't deserve that God should speak to him, and that he was lost without God speaking to him. My brother and wife are 15 years into their marriage, and they now still argue about who it was who asked the other out. My sister-in-law is adamant that it was my brother who asked her out. And yet he says that it was quite the opposite. And even if she didn't actually verbally ask, well, she made it fairly obvious that that's what she wanted to happen. Well, here in Genesis 12, there's no doubt at all. God called Abraham. There were not even any non-verbal signs from Abraham of that being what he wanted God to do. It was God's activity. And we then went on and noticed from the New Testament that our call to be Christian is exactly the same as Abraham's call here. That it's God's initiative in seeking out and saving people who are lost. Well, this morning we're going to move from the tortoise pace of six words in a sermon to a hare-like 2.5 verses. And we're going to focus on the promises that God gives to Abraham here in verses 1 to 3. And let me say right at the outset that just as the call that we saw last week was God taking the initiative, so here it is with the promises as well. In both the calling and the promises given, the object of these verses is God. Abraham becomes a Premier League character. Abraham becomes the most quoted Old Testament figure in the New Testament. Sure, but he's only a Premier League character because of God. It's God who calls him, and here it is, it's God who makes these promises to him. With no call, with no promises, well, Abraham would have remained as unforgettable as his ancestors are in chapter 11. After all, who's heard of Abraham's great-granddad, Serug? God is the subject of these verses. Notice here in verses 1 to 3, five times the text says, I will. These are promises from God to Abraham. Here is what God is going to do to Abraham, for Abraham, and through Abraham. And I want us to see this morning that they're possibly the most significant set of promises in the Bible. So let's look closely at verses 1 to 3. Cast your eye over them again, if you will, and I'm going to draw your attention to three distinct promises. Here in these verses we have the promise of future salvation. Here in these verses we have a promise of a heavenly multitude. And here in these verses we have a promise of global mission. Now, before you rub your eyes and you think that you can see none of those phrases here mentioned in verses 1 to 3, and you wonder whether the preacher's brought his wrong set of notes with him this morning, let me assure you, there is no mention verbally of future salvation in verses 1 to 3, you're right. There's no mention of a heavenly multitude verbally and in word terms here in verses 1 to 3, and there's no real mention of global mission here in verses 1 to 3, yet those are the promises God makes to Abraham. Those are the promises. And let's see how and take them one by one in turn. First, there's a promise here of future salvation. A promise here of future salvation. Reading through verses 1 to 3, it's hard to miss the theme of blessing. Five times the Hebrew word bless or blessing occurs. God will bless Abraham, and others will be blessed through him. Verse 2 states the blessing directly on Abraham. Look at verse 2 and the first part of the verse. And I will make you a great nation and I will bless you. And that promise to bless Abraham is one of the most striking statements in the whole Bible. I think we miss something of the startling force of what those four words mean. I will bless you. I suspect that we miss it because most of us don't understand the way the Bible uses the word bless. You see, We miss it because the word bless for us, well, it's a bland, nebulous sort of word that's used in children's prayers. Here, God bless mummy, God bless daddy, and God bless Fido. Or we use the word bless when someone sneezes. Bless you. So the phrase God bless means little more than, well, I hope everything goes okay for you. Well, let me say that the Bible means much more by this word bless. It has a much bigger and a much more startling content. You remember something of the Bible story so far, chapters 1 to 11, really, so far. Adam and Eve received, we're told, God's blessing in the Garden of Eden. There they were in the Garden of Eden, and in Genesis 1:28, the writer tells us that God blessed them. That is, they lived in perfect relationship with God in the garden. But in chapter 3, the very next chapter after the garden incident, we discover that they rebelled against God, they rebelled against his right to rule their lives, and instead of blessing, God placed his curse on them. God placed his curse on them and on all the creation. So Adam and Eve lost God's previous blessing, and they were separated from God, separated from one another, with a death sentence placed on them. And by the time we get to Genesis chapter 12, well, Abraham is in exactly the same situation. Abraham, as we saw last week, was an idolater. Joshua 24 tells us that. That he was lost. That he was under God's judgment. That Abraham was facing death and eternal separation from God. And suddenly God, undeserved by Abraham, only by grace, God promises to bless him. God promises to bless Abraham. Now, what does it mean? Well, if you'd read Genesis 1 to 11 so far, well, the conclusion would have to be that here is a promise to undo or to reverse the curse of Genesis 3. To remove the judgment that's on Abraham. To bless Abraham as God had blessed Adam and Eve. That is, to allow them relationship with him. Instead of death, a promise to enjoy life. Instead of separation from God, a promise to enjoy friendship with God. Instead of being under God's judgment, a promise to be right with God. Now, the promise to bless Abraham here is a promise of salvation. The promise of rescue from deserved punishment. The promise of deliverance from God's rightful wrath. Now, you may be thinking, surely he's making a bit of the word bless. Can you really read into this word bless all that's being read into it? Well, if you don't believe me that that's what the word bless means here in Genesis 12, well, I wonder whether you'll believe Paul the Apostle. I wonder whether you'll believe Paul's New Testament commentary on this verse. And to see that, I wonder whether you turn on to page 178 in the back part of the Bibles to Galatians chapter 3. Galatians chapter 3. Page 178. There are a number of cross-references, I'm afraid, this morning. You're going to have to keep your fingers warm and keep them active. Galatians 3, page 178. And what's going on here is that Paul is arguing the fact that salvation comes apart from keeping Jewish law. That Gentiles who have become Christians don't have to be circumcised when they become Christians. That you don't have to become Jewish to be saved. And Paul's great example is Abraham in verse 6. Thus Abraham believed God and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. How did Abraham get right with God? Well, it was through faith. It was through faith and not through law. It wasn't through keeping laws that Abraham was considered right with God. Abraham was made right with God apart from law. And look on to verse 9 at what Paul goes on to say. So then, those who are men of faith are blessed with Abraham who had faith. The blessing that Paul here talks about Abraham receiving in verse 9, the blessing promised back in Genesis chapter 12, well, it's the same as to be reckoned righteous. That is, to be in a right standing before God. I wonder whether you can see the connection that Paul's made in verses 6 and 9 of Galatians 3. Abraham was promised blessing, and he's being reckoned righteous That is, his being right with God is what that blessing is. See, it's not far-fetched to say that blessing, the promise to be blessed, is a promise to be made right with God. To be right with God? Well, it's a legal phrase. It's a legal phrase that comes from the law court, to be reckoned righteous. It means that there's no longer judgment placed on the individual. It means that there's no longer curse or penalty for sin upon that person. It means he's spared the judgment that he in fact rightfully should deserve. You see, to be blessed by God here is to be saved from God's judgment. And if you read on in Galatians, you'll see that the benefits of that being made right with God now, the benefits of that right standing before God, well, the benefits are largely future. So cast your eye to chapter 4 and verse 7 on the same page. So through God, you are no longer a slave, but a son, and if a son, then an heir. And you can only be an heir if there's a future inheritance to have. Or cast your eye to the columns alongside in chapter 5 and verse 5. Here's the person who's right with God. Well, through the Spirit, by faith, we wait for the hope of righteousness. We're waiting for something that's future. So the full benefits of being blessed by God are not yet. Right with God now, secure for future. So when God made the promise to Abraham back in Genesis chapter 12, that didn't mean that he returned straight to a Garden of Eden situation then. The blessing, the promise of no curse, the promise of being right with God, is a promise that when he dies in the future, a promise that in the end he won't have to face God's judgment, that he'll be spared God's judgment. God says to Abraham, I will bless you. Here in Genesis 12 is a momentous part in the history of the Bible. God is promising that beginning at Abraham, the curse could be undone, that the judgment of Genesis 3 could be escaped, that the results of man's rebellion against God could be reversed, and that once again blessing could come as it had come upon Adam and Eve back in the garden. A promise of blessing. Let me say, that promise is entirely of grace. Abraham has done nothing to warrant that God should make this promise to him. He's done nothing to deserve it. Without this promise and God fulfilling it, well, Abraham would have remained cursed. He would have remained under God's judgment. And that's a frightening prospect for when he died. A frightening prospect. That to die without God's blessing is to die under God's judgment. And to die under God's judgment is to be separated from him eternally. God promises blessing to Abraham. That is a promise of future salvation. A promise to be spared judgment day. A promise to be as God created Adam and Eve to be in the garden. A promise to be in relationship with God for eternity. It's a big promise, isn't it? I will bless you. The promise of future salvation. Second here in these verses, in Genesis chapter 12, we see the promise of a heavenly multitude. So if you're not back there already, turn back, if you would, to Genesis chapter 12, and it's on page 9. It's quite cold in here. It'll keep your fingers warm. Genesis chapter 12. Now look again at verses 1 to 3, and you'll notice that the promises here in verses 1 to 3 are more detailed and more specific than just this momentous promise of blessing, of future salvation. So in verse 1, notice that Abraham is promised a land. A land that will be given to him or shown to him by God. In verse 2, notice that there's a promise that from him will come a great nation and that Abraham will have a great name. Specific promises given by God to Abraham. First, in verse 1, he's promised a land. So our natural question is going to be, where is it? If God promises Abraham a land, where will that land be? Where's its location? What are its geographical boundaries? And when you read through Genesis, even from chapter 12 onwards, when you read through Genesis, you'll be forgiven for thinking that the promised land is Canaan. That's the land that God's going to give. And at first sight, that seems to be what the Old Testament says. So that even Jews today believe that they have a right to a physical land, because God had promised it to them through Abraham. And that's why they fight for it today, and fight for it tooth and nail. That's why 1948 is so significant for Jews, because they believe it was God giving back to them the land of the promise. Here of Genesis 12, that's why it's so important for them. But the very striking thing is that Abraham understood that Canaan wasn't the promised land. Abraham understood that this physical, geographical land of Canaan was only ever a foretaste or a foreshadow, a visual aid of the land that God was going to give. That Canaan was not the promised land. No, Canaan understood that the land of this promise had no physical boundaries. It needed no dictates over border controls from Jack Delors. No, Abraham knew that the land wasn't of this world. That the land that was being promised here was heaven itself. Well, how do we know that? Well, keep your finger in Genesis 12. Did you ever wonder why you were given 10 fingers? I'm sure it was for sermons. And I wonder whether you turn with me to page 210 of the New Testament, to Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11 on page 210. It's a great part of the Bible. It's the Hall of Fame, the Hall of Faith, the Madame Tussauds of the Bible, if you like. On page 210, Hebrews 11. And let me draw your attention to what it says about Abraham. Here first in verses 9 and 10. By faith he sojourned in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked forward to the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. And then down to verse 13. These all died in faith, that's Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, not having received what was promised, but having seen it and greeted it from afar, and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles in the earth. For people who ask thus make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of that land from which they had gone out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. Abraham understood the land to be heaven. And when you realize that, then you can look back into Genesis and you can see clearly the hints that that was indeed Abraham's understanding. Say, for example, he only lived in tents. Abraham never settles in Canaan. Well, he never lives there in a permanent way. He's always in tents. He doesn't build his house and he never takes out a mortgage. Further, in Genesis chapter 23, later on, when Sarah, his wife, dies, he insists on buying a plot of land to bury her in. The people recognize that the land was in fact Abraham's. They say he can have the land. But Abraham insists on buying it because he recognizes that the physical land wasn't the one that God had given. That it's at best a foretaste of the promised land. A foretaste of heaven. So God promises a land to Abraham, but it's the promise of heaven itself. But then in verse 2, I'm afraid we're back in Genesis 12 now. Page 9, back in the Old Testament bit. But back in verse 2, not only is the promise of a land, but the promise is of a great nation and him having a great name. Now, in the sweep of Genesis, it's fascinating that God is promising through his own, God's activity, the very things that the people in chapter 11 couldn't have. Back in chapter 11, the people built the Tower of Babel. And in verse 4 of chapter 11, what they wanted to do was make a great name, and they wanted to make it for themselves, by themselves. But God judges them for that, and he scatters them right across the world so that they can never be a great nation. What God won't allow at Babel because of man's pride and man's rebellion against God, he now promises to give to Abraham. Further indication for us that what is going on here with Abraham are the beginnings of the reversal of God's judgment. God's judgment at Babel was that they couldn't have a great name and they weren't going to be a great nation. God's promise to Abraham was both. The promise of a nation and the promise of a great name. But let me say that it's going to take a miracle for both of those things to happen. For look at chapter 11 and verse 30. Remember the promises of a great nation, but verse 30 of chapter 11. Now Sarah was barren and had no child. That's rather indelicately put by the RSV. I suspect today we've found better and more sensitive ways of saying that she was not able to have children. But it's very stark in verse 30, isn't it? She was barren. She couldn't have children. So how was Abraham going to found a great nation or a great people? How could he do it? Later on in Genesis, the promise of this people was that it was going to be so vast that his descendants would be as many as the stars in the sky or the grains of sand at the seashore. And let me say that that is a lot. If you want to give the kids something to do in the summer holidays at the beach, it would be a good idea to ask them to count the grains of sand on the beach. You see, for God to promise a great nation of those proportions, it's going to take a miracle. It's going to take a miracle to get even one descendant. And of course, as we read on, we discover in the later chapters that that son comes by miracle, the son, the birth of Isaac. A great nation or a great people. And as you read through the Old Testament, so you see that promise beginning to be fulfilled. So when Joseph goes to Egypt, we discover that there are 70 descendants. But in Egypt, they breed like rabbits. Well, or as Exodus 1:7 puts it slightly differently, but the descendants of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and greatly exceeded. Well, I think that's the same idea. They become a huge people, great in number, such that later on at Mount Sinai, God calls them the people of God, and they're called a nation. They're called a holy nation. But read on in the Bible, read on into the New Testament. Well, the description of the nation is still the people of God. But in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 9, Peter describes now, well, it's the church as this nation. So we are the nation that was promised to Abraham. Literally, we are the nation of Israel. Be interesting to go in a synagogue on a Saturday and say that to them. No, we're the nation of Israel. And that nation, that's us, we'll gather together in the land. Well, we'll only ever do that in heaven. It's the only place that's big enough for us all to be together at one time. So in Revelation, John's picture in chapter 7 and verse 9 is of a huge multitude gathered together. You see these specific promises to Abraham in chapter 12 of people in a place or of a nation in a land. Well, the New Testament tells us that that promise is fulfilled with the church in heaven. That's the fulfillment of these promises of a heavenly multitude, so vast that no one can count them, so huge they're without number. God's promise to this idolater, remember, Abraham, will be fulfilled finally in heaven. They're the significant promises, aren't they? Because I suspect they ought to remind us first of what a big God we're dealing with. That we're dealing here with a God of grace. Abraham didn't deserve any of these promises. It should remind us that we're dealing with a God who's in sovereign control of all history. A God who, as we read the Bible, so we see these promises being fulfilled. So we see God working these promises out. These promises of Abraham. So we see not only a big God, a God in control of the whole of human history, but we see a God who's faithful in keeping his promises. And that ought to encourage us today. It ought to encourage us that we believe in a God who keeps his promises. And as we see these promises fulfilled, well, I suspect it ought to remind us that there's no land that's home for us. You see, if we are the people, if we're this great nation, well, we're not yet in the land that was promised to Abraham. So the best that we are here is refugees. We call ourselves St. Helens in exile. All Christians are in exile. Because our promised land, the land promised to Abraham, and therefore to us, well, it's heaven. So as the children's chorus used to go, this world is not my home, I'm just a passing through. My treasure's laid up somewhere beyond the blue. Whatever the blue meant. But like Abraham, we won't live in a, well, we don't live in this world as if it's our permanent residence. Sure, we don't live in tents, but we must remember this land is not our home. This is not the promised land, that's heaven. And like Abraham, we'll keep our eyes fixed on that. The promise of future salvation, God's blessing, means there's escape from judgment for Abraham. The promise of a heavenly multitude that through Abraham there's going to be a great nation in a promised land, the church in heaven. And then the third and final promise here is a promise of global mission. And we're in Genesis 12 for the last time. If you're completely confused as to where we are now, we're in Genesis 12. Because here in Genesis 12 and verses 1 to 3, there's a further strand to these promises in the second half of verse 2 and verse 3. For here we're told in these verses that Abraham's blessing has a wider sphere of influence than just himself. The second half of verse 2 makes that clear. So that you will be a blessing. The blessing is wider in verse 3. Because of God's promise to bless those who bless Abraham and curse those who curse him. So, well, God's blessing here in the first half of verse 3 is not going to be on everybody. Abraham's blessing, we'll see in the second half of verse 3, is indeed will extend to all the families of the earth, but it's not going to extend to every individual. There's no universalism here. There's a promise of a wider sphere of blessing than just Abraham, that it will reach out, this blessing, to others. The end of verse 3, it will reach out even to all the families of the earth, but it's not going to be to every individual. Because there's a response that's going to have to be made to enjoy this blessing. From verse 3, that response appears to be that you have to bless Abraham. And next week we're going to go on to show that that becomes, for us, a call to follow or copy the faith of Abraham. Without it, if people didn't respond like Abraham, well, they remain under God's curse or judgment. Those who curse Abraham will be cursed, will remain under God's curse. And we'll tease out a little bit more of that response next week when we come to the response to these promises. But I want to draw your attention finally to the end of verse 3, because the end of verse 3 is a fascinating promise. By you, all the families of the earth shall bless themselves. Now, the wider sphere of influence of Abraham, it's a promise of worldwide mission. All the families or clans or people groups of the world will receive blessing. Now, you'll notice here that there's a textual problem that the RSV draws our attention to. Should the text be translated at the end of verse 3, that they will bless themselves, or is it that they will be blessed, as the footnote puts it? The Hebrew apparently allows either. Which should it be? Well, the New Testament gives us the key to translation, and more importantly, the New Testament gives the key to interpretation. So I wonder whether for the last cross-reference you turn back to Galatians chapter 3. Back in Galatians chapter 3, a final time. Remember that here in Galatians 3, Paul is defending his Gentile mission. He's defending that you don't have to be Jewish for salvation, that you can indeed be Gentile. Why? Well, because salvation has always been by faith and not by law. And so he says, remember Abraham, verse 6. He received his salvation. He was reckoned righteous by God. How? By believing God, by faith. And so he's the father, he's the first, he's the model of faith. If Abraham can get to be right with God through faith, then it's possible for Gentiles to get to be right by faith and not by law. But more, verse 8. God announced that this would be so. God announced that this would be so, that Gentiles could get right with God, that Gentiles could be blessed. He announced it long ago by preaching the gospel beforehand to Abraham. So Paul's saying that right at the outset, when God first called Abraham and made these promises to him, he promised that the blessing would extend to all nations. And so Paul here in verse 8 quotes the promise from Genesis chapter 12 and gives us both the translation and what it means. So he preached the gospel beforehand to Abraham, saying, "In you shall all the nations be blessed." Abraham had the gospel preached to him, that God would bless all nations through him, that this blessing, this future salvation, would be extended to all. At the beginning of the people of God, it's announced that God's plan is for Gentile mission. And Paul understood that. The Jews of his day, the Jewish Christians particularly of his day, thought that the blessing of God was to a restricted group. Like many times in the Old Testament, they thought that the restricted group was just themselves. That was the people that God would bless, and it was exclusively them. Oh no, thank God that Paul understood that his understanding of the promise to Abraham, that it drives him out. It drives him out from just Jewishness, drives him out from just Jewish prejudice, and it drives him out with the gospel literally to all the nations. So it drives Paul out to take the gospel to Asia. It drives him out to take the gospel to Europe, planning to take the gospel to Spain. Now the promise of God was that his blessing would extend right across the world. And so when we see in the picture in Revelation of that heavenly multitude, of the people in the land, well, how does John describe what he sees in his vision? He describes a people that are from every nation, every tribe and tongue, that every race and colour is included. God's people, that is the church, the nation, in God's place, that is heaven, enjoying God's blessing, that is free from the curse, free from judgment, well, that people will be an international and cosmopolitan group. And if that's God's promise, and if that's God's promise and we'll see it ultimately fulfilled in eternity, well, then our part, like Paul, must be to take the gospel to all nations. And it must be like Paul giving up any prejudices or any pre-ideas that God's gospel is really, God's blessing is really, well, only for certain types of people. Really only for certain groups of people. It's certainly not for people of other countries. Well, and certainly not for people of other religions. That it's only really for people like us. Oh, we're going to have to repent of any idea of that. Because God promised right here back at the founding of the people of God that the blessing would extend to all peoples, all nations, even to people like us. And there should be gratitude in our heart that God has allowed this blessing to extend to us. The call of Abraham. God gives these three great promises to him. They look so unlikely in Genesis 12, don't they? Abraham's old. His wife's barren. I mean, she's unable to have children. Abraham's an idolater and therefore ought to face judgment. And God gives to him these essential promises that to Abraham and then on to many others that will be from all nations, that together they'll become a great people, called a nation. That those people together will receive blessing. That is, they'll be free from the curse. That is, free from future judgment. And that they'll occupy a land, heaven itself. In Genesis 12, we get these three great promises that really the rest of the Bible is just how those promises are worked out. How those promises are fulfilled. How God is going to show his faithfulness to the promise and fulfill them. Well, where do we fit in? Where are we in the history of these promises? They're made back in Genesis chapter 12, and we're going to see them fulfilled in heaven. So where are we in them at the moment? Well, we're part of the people. We're part of the nation. We're part of the church. And big as it is, it's not yet the final multitude. It's not yet from all nations. And it therefore ought to drive us out with the gospel to others. The land. It's not yet occupied by us. Because we wait for heaven. And therefore our eyes are going to be on heaven. And we'll hold and cling loosely to the things of this world. Because they're not our ultimate destiny. The blessing. It's promised to us. We see glimpses of the blessing now. We're right with God now, for example. We have the Spirit now, for example. But of course, ultimately, we're waiting for the full and final blessing. That will be like Adam and Eve back in the Garden of Eden before the curse. That will be in proper relationship with one another and no need for cover-ups before one another. And ultimately, of course, will be in relationship with God properly. Such that we'll see him face to face. They're the great promises to the promises of Abraham, the promises God makes to him. And we stand, as they're being fulfilled, waiting for their final fulfillment, there in heaven. There's a children's chorus that begins, "What a mighty God we serve, what a mighty God we serve, what a mighty God we serve, what a mighty God we serve." Well, I guess it's going to win no prizes for poetry, but its theology is absolutely right. We have got a mighty God, and the response ought to be that the mighty God is the one we'll serve. Let's pause and pray together.